Lessons I've Learned, a series of podcasts by global consultant, best-selling author, and former Harvard Business School professor, David Maister.
Hello, I'm David Maister. This series of 15 podcasts is called Managing Professionals, Attitudes, Skills, and Behaviors. It's designed to help people who have the responsibility for managing a group of professionals. This 13th episode is called Develop Your Group's Rules of Membership and is based on my book First Among Equals, co-authored with Patrick McKenna. In previous episodes, we've discussed the manager's role and characteristics and a number of issues in managing individuals. The last episode was about clarifying group goals, and this one's about developing agreements on how your group is going to function. One of the major problems of groups is that they often have no explicit shared agreement on what it means to be a group. They've not discussed, let alone reached a consensus on, what responsibilities they owe each other, nor on what principles their group will operate. Many so-called groups are really just collections of people who in subtle ways are each simply pushing their own special interests. Members avoid dealing directly with each other when performance is lagging or when individuals behave annoyingly and obstruct progress. Because professionals jealously guard their autonomy, reserving the right to work as they see fit, professional groups have a greater than average tendency to become ill-disciplined. Take an all-too-typical group meeting. At 4 o'clock, the scheduled start time, people begin to enter the boardroom and drop their papers off at their favorite seating place, whilst quickly scanning the room to see if anyone more powerful or senior than themselves is already there. Seeing none, and with their papers now signifying that they were on time, they rush back to their offices on the pretext of making just one more quick client call. Then there's that insecure person who brings his work into the meeting to impress upon everyone else just how busy he or she really is. And of course, there's the person who accepted responsibility for an important project at the last minute, but who quickly reveals that he or she has no specific action to report, which doesn't prevent her from talking aimlessly and at length to try and cover up that fact. In the face of such behavior, members are quick to blame the group leader for being unable or unwilling to deal with quickly and decisively these self-serving or non-contributing members. These people say things like, "This is George's group. We're there to lend a hand and provide some ideas when he asks for them. But when things get off the track or people are wasting time, it's his responsibility to set things straight. If someone else in the group isn't delivering the goods, then as long as it doesn't negatively impact my client work, then that's the group leader's concern. If I'm asked to give my opinion, I'll give it, but there's no sense in ruffling anyone's feathers to make your point." Well, what's needed instead of this is an approach that will create a more inspiring system that provides for higher levels of shared enthusiasm, decision-making, performance, participation, and morale. This can be done by basing your group on three fundamental principles. Number one, mutual accountability. All group members must hold one another accountable for individual and group performance. Number two, shared contribution. All group members must have an opportunity and an obligation to contribute. Number three, shared values. All group members must adhere strictly to the values, principles, and standards established by the group. First, let's discuss setting levels of mutual accountability. The group leader must ensure that the group members primarily feel a sense of accountability to each other, not to the leader. That's being the boss. Group members must have high expectations of each other. They must expect that everyone will contribute to the extent that each is capable. They must feel unhappy and frustrated when certain members of the group itself is not performing well. There's no better way to achieve all of this than to clarify the rules and principles on which the group will operate. A basis for every championship team in every endeavor is having hard and fast, non-negotiable ground rules that everyone agrees to abide by. Great groups formulate and commit to writing a set of ground rules for how their team will work together and how they will manage themselves, thus bringing about constructive peer pressure. You write down what we have a right to expect from each other. For example, is it acceptable for group members to confront those who don't complete the projects that they have accepted responsibility for? Those who place their personal agenda ahead of the group's goals? Is the group leader to be the only individual responsible for the group's collective performance, or should individual group members be expected to be responsible for each other? It's wise to discuss and establish explicitly some very basic ground rules for your group. They will serve as a group conscience, having a positive impact upon your group's performance. Sensible issues that the rules could cover include mutual respect and cooperation, interpersonal communications and expressions of ideas, how you're going to make decisions and resolve conflicts, support for personal risk-taking, frequency and format of group meetings, rules on meeting attendance and punctuality, participation in group business development efforts and sharing of clients, completion of individual projects that you've signed up for, client service standards and handling of complaints, expectations about learning and sharing knowledge, standards on supervision, training, delegating, and staffing of engagements, and finally, constructive feedback and performance evaluations. Now, at the risk of beating the point to death, what I'm trying to draw to your attention is it's a lot easier to generate these agreements and generate these rules if you discuss them right at the beginning of the formation of your group, not when there is a particular problem in order to deal with. Some of the practical and important ground rules I've seen include the following. Meetings of the group and prompt attendance are a priority. Unless there's a client emergency, everyone's required to attend on time. Number two, you must honor commitments. If you say you're going to do something, you must do it. If you can't accomplish a task, don't say you can. If you've committed to do something and a problem arises that will prevent you from following through, let us know in advance. Be receptive to all new ideas. Don't tell us about someone who's tried this before and failed or why it won't work unless you have constructively addressed how we can make this work. Don't point fingers or assign blame. Every success will be treated as a group success, and every failure is an opportunity for the group to self-correct, to learn something new, and to constantly improve. Maintain confidentiality. The group's dysfunctional processes are the group's business. Don't badmouth our team or any individual members or discuss contentious issues outside of our group. These are, in fact, critical agreements that members of a team must arrive at. In great groups, the players police themselves. People hold themselves and each other accountable. Discipline boils down to several basics. Do that which one commits to doing. Live within the agreed-upon rules. Stick to standards. This should not be too difficult to accomplish. And yet, in fact, it's not that common. The world's leading expert on teams, Katzenbach, says that teamwork is not about togetherness. Teamwork is about discipline. Basic ground rules foster trust and openness and establish common expectations for members' behavior. They provide a guide for how your team will operate on a day-to-day basis. The best ground rules are concrete, agreed upon by all members, always kept visible, consistently observed, and specific as to consequences. Let's go through these criteria. First, be concrete. A ground rule like show respect for your fellow group members may sound good, but it isn't likely to work if it's not concrete. If you were showing respect for one another, you would observe that people would have their say without interruption from others. So a better ground rule might be, we agree that only one person will speak at a time, we allow people to complete their statements before responding, and we will refrain from having side conversations during our meetings. Now that's concrete, and it is worth being that specific. Second, a good ground rule is one that is agreed upon in advance by all group members. Majority rule does not build accountability. Total consensus is what makes the rules come alive. Everyone must agree to accept the group's rules, actively support them, and be confronted if his or her behavior contravenes any of the agreed upon rules. Great groups will also go to great effort to ensure that new members agree to the existing ground rules as a condition of joining or as an expression of their commitment to the group. Third, rules work if they are always kept visible. People give more credibility and pay closer attention to that which is committed to writing and kept in sight. Great groups ensure that every member has a copy of the ground rules and may even refer to them at the beginning of potentially contentious items on any meeting agenda. Next, enforce your rules. Among the best performing teams, there's an understanding that any member may stop the play by calling a timeout if someone's behavior is inconsistent with or overtly contravenes the rules. If someone does something inconsistent with the defined standards, anyone in the group can and is encouraged to say, excuse me, didn't we all agree that? Finally, make sure your rules are specific as to consequences. Effective group leaders make sure that the group defines what the consequences will be if any of the group's ground rules are violated. If there are no consequences, there are probably no rules. Consequences are usually designed not to be overly punitive, but simply to serve as a gentle reminder that the standards are important. There might be a $2 sanction that gets contributed to funding the group's next beer bash or sent to a favorite charity. Or the rule might be that the last person into the meeting is obliged to take the minutes. The essential principle is that the group collectively sets and manages the ground rules, and then the ground rules manage the group. Now let's turn to setting levels of shared contribution. Being a member of any group of truly committed, exceptional people can have a motivating impact on each individual. To that end, high-performance groups demand some price, some requirement, and some commitment for membership. This approach incorporates one of the most fundamental motivators throughout human history, pride in belonging. Accordingly, the first question that must be addressed is, what is the price of membership into our group? When you establish a level of shared contribution in advance, you increase the likelihood that everyone will be freely cooperative, will contribute, and will be committed to achieving reciprocal benefits from working together. A good place to start is to ask how much investment time each person is willing to commit beyond their normal production or client service workload to furthering the group's objectives. While most firms are obsessed with the revenue production of their people, very little attention is given to the usually substantial amount of non-paid time that people spend at work. Yet it is precisely through the wise use of non-paid time, investments in the future, that effective groups achieve new things. There are two steps. Define how many investment hours each member is prepared to commit to the group, and then agree how those investment hours are to be used. Begin by determining how many hours in a week the average person devotes to your firm and its clients, including all activities. Suppose this comes to approximately 55 hours a week. Accounting for holidays, sick time, and vacation periods, we can conservatively project a work year of, say, 45 weeks, which will result in each person spending approximately 2,475 hours annually at the office. Your numbers may differ from mine. Work with your numbers, not mine. Next, deduct from this number of production, billable, or fee-earning, or client service hours that each person is prepared to work. Let's assume that the client service hours is, say, 1,800. Higher for some professions, lower for others. Thirdly, deduct from the total an allowance for personal time. Time to call the kids, fill in the timesheets, go to the bathroom. Let's say that's 175 hours a year. Now, deducting all of that still leaves, according to my arithmetic, about 500 non-production hours remaining for each individual as what is available to be contributed to the group's investment time. The next question becomes, how many of these very precious, discretionary, non-billable or non-reimbursed hours are you prepared to contribute to the group as part of your investment in the group's success? The group leader goes around the table and solicits each member's individual commitment. Now imagine that your people agreed to devoting a conservative 30% of the available hours to efforts on behalf of the group, leaving 70% of their investment time to be allocated to their own individual pursuits. So 30% of the 500 hours is about 150 hours each. Again, your percentage may be different than my guess. Use yours. That 150 hours per person per year, or 12 and a half hours per month, would provide ample time to attend one monthly meeting and also allow for an investment of at least one day every month to the implementation of some pre-selected activity that would advance the common interests of the group. Note that this is only a modest beginning. In firms where groups have functioned for a long time and true team play is the norm, it would be typical for people to contribute 80% or more of their available investment time to the group effort, retaining only 20% for purely individual initiatives. But you got to start somewhere. If each member of the group realizes that every other individual has also signed on to provide a relatively equal commitment, most people will then be prepared to do their part. They will want their colleagues to think of them as team players. Next, you must agree on how these investment hours are to be used. The next challenge is to ensure that people appreciate that the investment time contributed to the group is for projects and activities that will benefit the group as a whole. It is not merely to be spent in the pursuit of their own personal aspirations or projects that will only benefit their own personal agenda. That's what the remaining individual investment time is for. You must ensure that everyone understands this distinction and agrees to abide by that understanding. As specific activities are proposed, someone must ask, how specifically is the activity that you are proposing to undertake intending to benefit the whole group? A skilled coach would ensure that there was an absolute minimum of assigning tasks to people. We can all remember the meeting where someone in the group stuck George with the most terrible project since George wasn't able to attend that day. Now there's a surefire recipe for motivating one of your colleagues, I'm sure. The skillful group leader relies as much as possible on people volunteering for tasks about which they can be enthusiastic. It is also sometimes necessary for the coach to manage down the size or scope of a task that someone wants to take on. Since the important principle that you must keep your promises is established, the coach would never accept an undertaking to try to get this done. As the character Yoda said in the film Empire Strikes Back, do or do not, there is no try. You can use collective management of investment time to develop a group strategy. Here's how it's done. You give each member of the team four sheets of paper, each headed with one of four key objectives. Number one, raise client satisfaction. Number two, increase skill building and the dissemination of skills. Three, improve productivity and efficiency, not just production. And number four, get better work, not just more work. Beneath the objectives on each page are five columns. What action will get us there? Which individual will take responsibility for the action? How much time will we spend on each action? By when will it be done? And how will we know it's done? You tell each team that you, the group leader, will meet with them to discuss which actions they're prepared to commit to do over the next 3 months to make progress towards the four objectives. Notice that I recommend planning on a 3-month cycle. I've learned that annual plans are just like New Year's resolution, and they either don't get done at all, or everyone remembers to start working on them about October. Let people know that only actions will be accepted, not goals. Thus, it is not permissible to say, we will raise our market awareness. That's a goal. Instead, people must choose something like, put on 3 seminars on topics X, Y, and Z, or train juniors better is also too vague. They must write down something like, hold weekly discussion sessions with staff, including presentations by senior partners on their respective specialties. That's reasonably concrete. Each action must be the responsibility of a specific person. This is not meant to discourage teamwork. Different actions may be part of an integrated plan, but it's required to ensure a specific focus of responsibility. Many people may be involved in putting on a seminar, but some specific someone must be on the hook for ensuring that it all comes together and takes place. During the discussion of the action plan, you test the feasibility of the plan. Will the proposed actions really make a difference? Has enough time been budgeted to complete each action properly? Is there enough investment time available to do it all? Is the team leaning too much on a few individuals to get all of this done? Are there other people who have some time who could be brought into the effort? You should alternate between encouraging ambition. Couldn't you accomplish a little bit more in 3 months? Can't we put a bit more stretch into this plan? And then doing the other side, which is dampening excessive enthusiasms. Let's take it a step at a time. I recommend you limit yourselves to what you really think you can get done. Remember, we're asking for solid commitments here. If necessary, you might offer some suggestions, not instructions, for possible actions. Try to guide the team gently to actions that create the early successes that breed optimism and enthusiasm. This raises the morale and commitment to do more, to try it again. At the end of this session, the surviving plan becomes a contract between you and the team, or more correctly, between each team member and every other team member. Before the meeting concludes, a specific ironclad meeting date is chosen approximately 3 months hence to review the execution of the plan and its impact. What worked? What didn't? What proved easy to pull off? What is more complicated than it first looked? At that meeting, in addition to the look-back review, a new action plan covering the next 3 months using the same planning approach will be discussed and agreed to, and so on, until the process becomes a routine part of your group's operation. This approach is not a budgeting process, but is meant to complement the normal financial budgeting. Budgets describe what firms aim to accomplish with their reimbursed production time. This process provides a framework for groups to make wise use of their investment time. What a group does with its production time determines its income for the year. What it does with its investment time determines its future. The group leader plays a key role in this process, not by telling people what to do, but by encouraging each and every one of them to take responsibility for the group's success. You must make the process work by giving as much attention and seriousness to reviewing the investment action plans as you do the monthly financials. One part of this system is clearly crucial: follow-up. What will make the whole process work is that you, the group leader, will be coming round to see how well things have worked out. Not a year from now, but in 3 short months. The short cycle is essential to breed the sense of urgency that leads to action. Of course, even though the planning is done in 3-month cycles, there should be even more frequent formal and informal monitoring of actions and commitments than that. Monthly reporting of actions and progress would be sensible. Your final task is to establish your shared values. According to John Katzenbach, who I cited before as the co-author of The Wisdom of Teams, pride is a more effective motivator of professional talent than money is. And you can motivate that talent with pride in more than just belonging. There is pride in the specific work product that you deliver to clients. Pride in the kinds of clients that you serve. Pride in the expertise that you can apply. Pride in the values of your firm. Excitement, energy, and pride, and thus the accomplishment that drives financial success, can be created by building agreement that the group will conduct its affairs to higher standards than the group's competitors. The group voluntarily accepts greater discipline in monitoring and enforcing excellence, never settling for competence. To create this form of compelling challenge, the group must decide in advance what standard of excellence it is willing to see enforced. Among the most common non-negotiable minimum standards are things as follows. 1. Only truly superior work will be accepted. 2. There will be no room for mere competence in client satisfaction. We will operate as our clients' trusted advisors, not their technical experts. 3. Every person must have and be working on a personal development plan. No cruisings allowed. 4. No one will work on things that could be delegated to a more junior person. If it can be delegated, it must be. 5. Everyone must treat all others with respect at all times. 6. Anyone in charge of a client assignment will be required to supervise all the work on that assignment to a high level, since we owe a duty of due care to our clients to manage the affairs that they have entrusted to us. Now, any group that adhered strictly to standards like these would not only flourish commercially, but would create an enjoyable and fulfilling work environment for anybody who believed in those standards. The group leader must ensure that everyone in the group deals with each other according to a common set of values and principles that everyone actually believes in. What standards of minimum behavior would your group accept? In order to create a productive culture in which the members can take pride, the group leader must influence how people in the group treat each other. According to the results of my book, Practice What You Preach, the group leader must be absolutely 100% intolerant of the following behaviors by anyone in the group. Wait for this list. Abuse of power or position. Any disrespect shown by anyone to anyone else. Backstabbing. Betraying secrets. Bullying. Cruising. Dealing in blame. Gossiping, whining, and complaining. Hiding from accountability. Lack of teamwork, intimidation, non-compliance with standards, making one's own rules, unreliability and failure to keep promises, being political. What I'm reporting to you is that the best managers create teams that actually enforce those shared values and standards. I suggest sharing this list with your group and seeing if they too will agree that your group should show zero tolerance for these things. If they delete or add items to the list, all to the good. At least then you will have nagging rights to enforce a culture that they agreed to in advance. In the same spirit, there are certain things, as demonstrated in the book Practice What You Preach, that financially successful groups require. Number one is an attitude of, we don't care how it happened, let's just get it fixed. Number two, continual skill and career development for everyone is required. Number three, everyone must show diplomacy, courtesy, professionalism. Number four, team play is expected from everyone. Number five, everyone must be approachable. If people agree to standards like these, then it will become part of your job to be the culture cop. You must deal with non-compliance gently at first, but you must be prepared to escalate. In the long run, you will need to be intolerant and to enforce your group's values. I must stress that my advice is that you and your team must develop your values, which does not necessarily mean adopting those I've described here. There's no virtue in being a copycat. Your group must adopt the values that you and your group truly believe in, and not just those you think you should. There's a lot of work in setting your group's membership rules, but if you do this task well up front, you'll have a lot fewer management problems later on. This has been Develop Your Rules of Group Membership, the 13th episode in my 15-part series, Managing Professionals, Attitudes, Skills, and Behaviors. In the last two episodes, we'll look at the role of performance appraisals and compensation systems and conclude with a summary review episode containing last thoughts and suggestions for future reading. If you'd like more information or access to other podcasts in this series or the previous series, Marketing Professional Services, go to my website, davidmaester.com. This podcast series is now available for purchase, both as a single episode and as part of a DVD set, from my website, davidmaester.com/store, STORE. I'm also pleased to announce that my forthcoming book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker, is available for pre-order from this same location.